Morning in the matter of the Bank of New York Mellon versus Marianne Corradetti. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Michael O'Donnell, Riker, Danjic, Sher, Heilman, Peretti for the Bank of New York.
And Randolph Lafferty of Cooper Levinson on behalf of Anthony and Marianne Corradetti.
Morning, counsel, and welcome. Mr. O'Donnell, please go ahead.
Good morning, Justice. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for reply. May it please the court. This is an appeal of a trial court decision affirmed by the appellate division with partial remand, voiding a $1.8 million mortgage that was the subject of a refinance between Anthony and Marianne Corradetti's on Anthony and Marianne Corradetti's second home in Ocean City. The evidence at trial and even at summary judgment level could leave the rational fact finder with no doubt that the mortgage was not fraud, that the mortgage was not forged, and that the only way $1.8 million in prior mortgages that the Corradettis have admittedly agreed to was paid off was through this refinancing. The lower courts ignored this evidence to such an extent that it invokes the sense of wrongness that State v. Johnson 42 NJ 146 discusses when it says this court under the New Jersey Constitution has the ability to make amended findings of fact when there is the trial court is and the lower courts are so wide of the mark. Now, the actual evidence that proves this point are first the HUD one. The HUD one was dated September 25th and the Corradettis were in Croatia on that day. But they were back in New Jersey the very next day. And the HUD one actually says on the upper side of the box, says that it's printed on September 26, 2006. It expressly says, Title Express Settlement System, quote, printed 9/26/2006 at 1552 GS. Remarkably, the trial court even noted that, but did no analysis, made no conclusion, and said nothing more about it. The appellate division majority said nothing at all about it. Judge Accurso, in her dissent, did. She told you what that means in and of itself, that the mortgage was backdated and the Corradettis did indeed sign. But the most important evidence as to the HUD one, it's the only evidence anyone presented as to how the Corradettis paid off mortgage debt in the face amount of $2.3 million at that in 2006. They admit they entered into the Commerce mortgage in 2003 for $2.3 million. And Mrs. Corradetti initially denied that. But since that time, they've admitted in the appellate, in their appellate brief at page 4, and the appellate division made a finding of that. And the HUD one itemizes the disbursement, $1.352 million and $4,000 to World Bank. The HUD one also reflects property taxes and insurance being paid. And the cut and the answer, the logical conclusion is those funds paid off the mortgages because within 6 weeks, cancellations of both mortgages were filed and recorded. The Bank of New York mortgage is also notarized in Burlington County, where the Corradetti's Cinnamon's home is. And then we add the bank's payment ledger, specifically the bank's payments ledger with the Bank of America records and the Bayview records. The Bank of America records with the ledger being addressed to the Corradetti's home and addressed to them at 130 Taylor Lane, Citizen, New Jersey, reflects 30 payments of $13,126.16. It continues to reflect after the transfer to Bayview as servicer, payments of insurance and also of taxes through 2017. That was admitted in evidence as P5. And finally, on July 10, 2010, when the Corradettis were facing a final judgment in foreclosure, which had been previously dismissed, The Corradettis wrote the foreclosure unit and said that you are hereby notified that I object to the entry of final judgment in the above referenced matter. I disagree and dispute the amount owed. Now, what's significant about that is a number of things. First, Mrs. Corradetti denied that she signed that letter at trial. Now on appeal, they have admitted she did. That's set forth at page 8 of the defendant's appellate brief. They expressly say, on July 19th, Mary Ann Anthony Corradetti sent a pro se letter to the plaintiff's counsel. If you didn't enter into a mortgage, you wouldn't just dispute the amount. You would say, I don't know, I never entered into it. That's what a layperson would do. And that's what Judge Accurso found when she did her review and her analysis and found that the trial court went so far wide of the mark. And specifically, I think what she found goes to reason. She found to believe that the Corradettis did not enter into this mortgage, you would have to find that someone else entered into a refinance where they got absolutely no money from the transaction. They paid $8,000 for the $8,000. Then they made mortgage payments of almost $400,000 for another 2.5 years. And then they issued a 3-page letter, not disputing the mortgage, but disputing the amount. No rational fact finder could come to that conclusion. And that's why we say this is that very rare case that invokes the State v. Johnson parameters for this court and also the burden on the appellate division to do its own fact finding, because the trial division judge, Judge Pickering, missed the mark so wide that an injustice is undeniably being denied. Now let's look at what the Corradettis presented as the evidence of forgery, for which they had the burden of clear and convincing evidence. Mrs. Corradetti was the only witness who testified at trial. She was found to be not credible in every single instance, except for the fact that the court found she was credible that she didn't sign the bank.
So let's stop there and break this down. Now, I'm just talking about now the mortgage note. The reason why the judge found Ms. Corradetti credible about that is because Ms. Corradetti was in Croatia on September 25th, okay, and 8 days before that. And that particular, the notary public, okay, affirmed her signature there and the date, September 25th. Now the notary public might have been mistaken about the people who was before him, but shouldn't have been mistaken about September 25th. And I think it's a criminal act for the notary public to intentionally notarize a signature on a date that is incorrect. So like just with respect to that, why isn't there sufficient credible evidence in the record to support the judge's finding that Mrs. Corradetti couldn't have done that on September 25th when she was in another country?
Well, with regard to that, Justice Albom, first, as Judge Accurso pointed out, the reason for the backdating is to allow the loan to fund before the end of the month. But I would also say, Justice, the trial court division judge, if he believed that, could have granted summary judgment, but he didn't. What he said in his summary judgment decision is the facts submitted by defendants in support of the alleged forgery is that the signatures were not put on the mortgage documents on September 25th.
It couldn't have been because
the notary states. Everyone knew that at the time of the decision. But then he goes on to say, it does not follow from the fact that the signature was forged. It does not follow that the mortgage documents are invalid. It does not follow that the defendants owed money to the plaintiff. In fact, when viewed in lights most favorable to the plaintiff, The evidence is the defendant intended to give this mortgage, the defendants did sign the mortgage documents, were paid in full and discharged, and that the defendants made the payments for 2 years and did not make payments to the two previous mortgages after September 20th.
What are you reading?
That's Judge Pickering's analysis on the summary judgment at 813 of the appendix.
No, because there were disputed facts. He decided there were disputed facts and he conducted a trial. Then he heard the witnesses. I'm only talking about now the morgue. Then he heard the witnesses, okay? And then he made credibility findings. So I'm only talking about the forgery now. Forget about whether or not they made the payments later on. I'm only talking about the finding about the forgery. What is off? Why isn't there sufficient credible evidence to support his finding that they could not have signed it on September 25th when they were in Croatia on September 26th?
I understand.
And assuming there is a presumption of correctness concerning a notary public, we don't assume that they're corrupt. So go ahead.
Understand, Justice, that we're just talking about the forgery. But it wasn't a disputed fact at the summary judgment hearing that they were in Croatia on September 25th. That wasn't disputed.
Yeah, counsel, does the document itself negate the fact that it was signed on the 25th, since the document says it wasn't printed until the 26th? It couldn't have been signed before it was printed. Is that right, correct?
Absolutely, Justice. So let's
How do you know, what evidence is there in the record that it wasn't printed on September 26th with their signatures on from September 25th? What evidence in the record do you have to dispute that?
Is it the burden of the defendants?
Let him respond to that question.
Justice Alban, the HUD one itself. The HUD one expressly says Title Express GPS 1552. They're not going to take signatures and then send it back.
What is the date on the HUD one? Not the printed part. What is the date?
The handwritten date is September 25th.
How do you know that? What evidence is there that it wasn't scanned with the signatures on from September 25th on September 26th?
Well, the document itself, and no one has ever made that contention that somehow there was somebody signed forged documents on the 25th and then sent it back to the HUD one. September 26th, they put on.
She said she didn't sign it on the 25th. She said she was in Croatia. She said she didn't sign the HUD one on the 25th. She was in Croatia. I'm not talking about the rest of it, whether or not they paid. I don't know whether or not two other people pretending to be the Corradettis arrived on September 25th and deceived the notary public. I don't know, but the notary public certainly knew that whoever was signing on September 25th, unless the notary public was corrupt.
Mr. O'Donnell, can you help us and tell us the significance of the printed on September 26th? How is that generated? Is it generated more than once? Can you explain how that functions?
The HUD one would be generated by the title agent, right? And the title agent would be generating it from his forms, and then you would put in the numbers, and then you would have it executed. But you would not.
Can it be generated twice? Can it be generated the day after? The point that Justice Alban was highlighting, can you respond to that?
Well, you can have multiple HUD ones generated, but in this case, we only have one HUD one with the numbers, and that HUD one has a date that it was printed September 26th at 1552. That's when it was generated. And there is no evidence, zero, of a HUD one generated on September 25th.
Can I ask you a question about that generated?
Yes. Yes.
HUD-1 form isn't something like a typical clerk's forms where you pull it off a tablet, is it? It's something that the original form is generated by a computer on the paper, and that's the date you're talking about, not the date when it was Xerox copied or photocopied. It's the date the form itself, before it's filled out, is generated by some computer program to generate HUD-1 forms.
That is my understanding.
Most title agents, title companies, and closing agents would have, so that the form, before it was signed, before it was filled out, this is what you were relying on. Before it was signed, before it was filled out, when it was created to be completed to show the closing financial distributions, that was actually on the 26th. That's what you're relying on.
Yes, that is exactly what I'm saying.
So can you break down the burdens of proof that were applicable here? The burden for you, and then the burden on the defendant to prove the affirmative defense of forgery. Let's go over that.
The burdens of defense on me with regard to first proving the mortgage and its validity is preponderance of evidence. The burden to me as to every equitable remedy, equitable subrogation, ratification, and unjust enrichment is preponderance of evidence. Forgery has to be proved by clear and convincing evidence, which is a much higher standard.
Go ahead. Well, my question to you is, there is some way in which what happened here at trial can be perceived to be a shifting of the burden back to you to disprove forgery. Do you think that is what was going on here? Was there an impermissible shifting back of a burden before sufficient proofs had been made by the Corradettis?
Yes, I absolutely believe that is what happened, Justice Slovecki, because the only proof offered by the Corradettis, in essence, were they were in Croatia on September 25th. And Justice Sicurso even pointed out Mrs. Corradetti's testimony on her dissent alone wouldn't have been enough to shift that, because she was confused as to when she came back from Croatia. Mm-hmm. She had her passports and she was in Croatia on September 25th. But that's it. Other than that, you had a HUD-1 that was generated September 26th. She couldn't explain how prior mortgages that she admitted she agreed to were paid off. It reflected a closing. The bank ledger was put in evidence of 30 payments. She signed a letter to the foreclosure unit, not disputing the validity of the mortgage, but the amount.
And all of these cancellations and the new mortgages were recorded, of course, correct?
Yes, the new mortgages were absolutely recorded, and the old mortgages were canceled. So even if you believe that it was free and clear, you'd have to believe that all these mortgages are floating around before. Not the facts are clear that in 2000 they took out a $2 million loan. In 2003 it was $2.3 million. And then in 2006, $1.79 million was paid off. It was a mortgage by Countrywide at 6.75%. Some of the attack on the bank ledger was that Bank of America, the transfer from Countrywide to Bank of America, different servicers. Well, Bank of America acquired Countrywide. There wasn't different servicers. It was the same servicer. And the ledger itself is a different.
Mr. O'Donnell, can I take you back in light of your answers to Justice Lavecchia's questions to something that was brought up earlier, whether there is sufficient evidence in support of the trial judge's finding that Mrs. Corradetti didn't sign this on September 25th. Strikes me that there is, because it's undisputed that she was in Croatia, and that a concession on that point doesn't really hurt your case. There's sufficient evidence, is there not, that it wasn't signed on the 25th? Correct?
That is correct. She was incorrigible. She did not sign it, and that has never been part of our case.
So let's go to the next question. In light of the burden that you've just explained with respect to forgery, what proofs have your colleagues on the other side of the aisle come forward with that this is a forged signature other than the discrepancy in the date?
That is it. My client was criticized for not having a forgery expert, but the other side had the burden and did not produce a forgery expert.
Why didn't you call your forgery expert? You had one, and you didn't. And I know you weren't counsel below, but one wasn't called at the time of trial. You could have called a forgery expert. They have a presumption of validity that the thing was signed on the 25th. This is the law. There's a presumption of validity that the notarization occurred on the 25th. Under our standard of review, this has to be sufficient credible evidence in the record to support the trial court's finding. I'm talking about when it was notarized. The judge found, based upon the passport, passed upon the presumption of validity, it was done on the September 25th. Why is that crazy? Why is that incredible?
Well, because the judge also found in his summary judgment decision, all of that didn't mean that there was a forgery. That it all didn't follow. And the evidence at trial that was put on was that Mrs. Corradetti didn't know what she signed. That Mrs. Corradetti did everything.
Even if she didn't
know. Mr. Corradetti did everything.
Even
assuming. The evidence expressly the judge said was that Mrs. Corradetti was looking to her lawyer for the answers.
Assume that. Assume that you still have a notarized mortgage and note on the 25th when she was in Croatia.
You still have that. I still have a HUD 1 that says I paid off the prior mortgages.
So let's talk.
I still have cancellation of those mortgages. Entire amount.
I'm not talking about the rest of it. Let's talk about the HUD 1. I'm not saying that they weren't paying off. I'm just talking about these documents now. The HUD 1, they don't necessarily have to be printed out. You were suggesting that in your remarks. You put on a witness, and I'm not saying you, I'm not blaming you, okay, the trial, of a person who didn't know who only knew that stuff was in the file. Had no personal knowledge of anything, was producing documents, could not say anything about any of those documents. That's not the way a typical case should be tried. Do you agree?
Yes and no. This is the Chancery Division. And this is who deals with foreclosures. And a lot of these are securitized loans. And a lot of times you don't have people with personal knowledge. And in this particular case, the title agent was gone. The notary couldn't be found. The mortgage had been assigned. So there wasn't Mr. Corradetti who had all the knowledge of the financing, unfortunately had Alzheimer's. So there was no one who had personal knowledge. That's the whole point of the business record rules.
So even the record, you didn't present records showing that you guys paid off the mortgage. You didn't present checks showing that the Corradettis were making payments on the mortgage. I mean, there were so many things that could have been done and should have been done. We wouldn't be here today.
Justice Alvin, I disagree. I did present records. I presented a HUD one with the exact amounts of that mortgage, and there were satisfactions 3 to 6 weeks later. They are records. You don't have to provide every single check. And the Corradettis provided nothing. In fact, at the summary judgment motion, when asked who discharged the mortgage, their response was, I have no idea. They were discharged.
Are there canceled checks and bank statements from the Corradettis? Are they available for the 30 months of mortgage payments?
Yeah. I know a demand for discovery was made of the Corradettis. And they were, you know, I don't know whether their canceled check were not produced. That's all I can really, really say on that specific point.
I'm curious now. I'm going to stick to the standards that are applied to this case. We're an appellate body, as was the appellate division. Obviously, the credibility findings that the trial court made observing Mrs. Cordetti are not assailable. But aren't we allowed to review the rationality of the inferences that the trial court has chosen to draw from the facts that are in this record? And is that really what you're asking us to reevaluate legitimately as an appellate court to determine whether or not the leaps that were made by the trial court in the face of the evidence that you're pointing to, connecting the Corradettis to benefits achieved from this transaction, that you say were not rational and did not lead to the conclusion that the trial court reached? Is that a fair way of viewing what it is you are arguing for on appeal?
It's the first part. I do say Mrs. Cordetti's credibility is assailable and reviewable by this court. But let me address your question first. Yes.
But then break it into two parts, because I really do want you to focus on the inferential leaps that the trial court has made here in the face of, and different judges may view it differently, but you're making an argument that there were considerable proofs tying the Corradettis to this transaction, both at the time of the transaction, immediately afterward, and for a considerable period thereafter.
I would say, and I referenced the court to the appellate court's decision on Aldecero v. Medical Center of Ocean County, where the court said, the focus of dispute is not on credibility. The alleged error is the fact finder's evaluation of the underlying facts and the implications therefrom. And C.B. Snyder as well. And I think that's the real error both lower courts engaged in here, is the evaluation of all of the facts could lead to only really one rational conclusion, that there was a closing and the mortgages were signed. And there's just a number of factors to that. There's no other explanation as to how the prior
Do we have to go that far? Could we simply go so far as to say there were not sufficient rational bases for the inferential leaps that the trial court made on the forgery issue exclusively?
Yeah,
without challenging some of the other factual determinations that the trial court chose to make. I mean, the case was being sent back anyway.
You absolutely could do that, Justice Levecchia. But you asked me to itemize all of the items. I would just say, you know, the issues of the prior mortgage, the issues of the HUD one having been generated on 2006, all of those, the fact that the cancellations came within 3 to 6 weeks, or the fact that the Corradettis had no other explanation for that, the striking similarities in the signatures, in every single instance, all of that could lead to there's no other rational conclusion. And I think that's what Justice Accurso was really getting at, is if you logically looked at what happened, there's no other explanation that someone would forge these mortgages. No mm-hmm. one else could have gotten anything out of this closing mm-hmm. but the Corradettis. And that led Judge Pickering and the appellate division to engage in speculation or to say there should have been more. But they didn't look at the evidence as a whole, as State v. Johnson says. Now, as to my second part, I think this court very well can review the trial court's credibility decisions. And I would simply cite to the court Pioneer Title v. Lucas, where the court said, if you're thoroughly satisfied that the findings and ultimate conclusions are clearly mistaken and so plainly unwarranted that the interest of justice demand intervention and correction, we should appraise the record as if we were deciding the matter at exception
And counsel, can I ask you a question? It's because of your last response that these signatures were so similar. Like, why did you had a handwriting expert? Like, why didn't you present the handwriting expert at trial? I mean, the other side has a passport, not testimony, a passport saying I'm in a different country on the day of this notarization, and you want now the court to be looking at these signatures and figuring out whether or not they're the same ones? Why didn't you present a handwriting expert?
I didn't say the court needed to look at these signatures. I said that was just one more element of proof, Justice Albin. I thought it.
Are you asking us to look at the signatures and figure out whether or not they're the same, without presenting a handwriting expert?
Whose burden of proof is to prove that it's a forgery? Is it the defendant's?
I've
asked the question too, Justice Albin.
I know, but I want a response to my question, then we can get to your question.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, yes. What I want you, that would be the last portion of what I would want you to look at. I would want you to look at the HUD one.
But do you want us to
cancellations of mortgage?
Just to compare the signatures is what I'm asking you.
That would be if yes. If you find the trial court judge went so wide of the mark that intervention is required, yes, that is what I'm asking for, Justice. Yeah. Now, Justice Fernandez-Vina, to answer your question, the party that has the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence is forgery is the Corradetti's, as Judge Accurso pointed out in her dissent, and noted that they did not present a forgery expert, or handwriting expert, at any time. And the court certainly gave them a deadline.
Was that a trial strategy decision? They didn't provide an expert, so in turn, there was no need for you to provide an expert to counter that expert?
Well, I was not the trial counsel, but I can imagine, yes, I can imagine, you know, the trial counsel at that time, sat down and he had a witness who basically was not credible. There was no other explanation for the payoff of the prior mortgages, which assumed the entire amount of the debt. And he rested. And he also had a chancery division judge. When he denied the Corradetti's summary judgment, actually said, counsel said, this is not the weakest, one of the weakest summary judgment motions I've submitted. I hope so. So he had no indication that Judge Pickering was going to ignore the evidence that he put on, and that had some, you know, had at least some persuasive effect at summary judgment, and then went on again in trial. And Mr. Orlando did go through the payment ledgers, get them notarized. And with regard to that, Judge Pickering expressly said, with regard to the Bank of America records, which have those payments, the court finds the Bank of America would have a duty to make sure the records are accurate. They were certainly business records. And because of that, the documents were for the purposes of the rules of relevance, 803C, the document was trustworthy.
We're a little bit beyond the half hour at this point. And I wondered if you could just tell us, what's the relief that you seek at this point? Judge Accurso, in her dissent, said that the matter should be remanded either for a retrial or a dismissal without prejudice. What are you asking for?
First, it should not be a dismissal without prejudice, but I think this court should reverse with instructions. At a minimum, it should be reversed with instructions that an equitable subrogation award be entered. I think also this court has the ability to reverse with instructions as to the forgery. And as to the ratification, the records are what they are. And obviously the court always has the ability to remand for consideration of forgery and equitable subrogation. But the evidence on a remand is not going to change that dramatically. It's all set forth here.
Other questions, anyone? We'll have you back for rebuttal, Mr. O'Donnell.
Thank you, Justice.
Mr. Lafferty.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Good morning, members of the court and counsel. I had the privilege of representing Anthony and Marianne Corradetti. Anthony, unfortunately, was ill during my handling of this matter. It was previously handled by my partner, Michael Jacobson, who unfortunately passed away in October. But Anthony passed away on October 19th, 2019, and Marianne passed away on December 9th, 2019. And for the last 10 years of their life, they waged a battle with this lender who repeatedly tried to dispossess them of this property, all the while contesting the validity of this mortgage. What we're here about is these events began back in September of 2006. And as the justices correctly noted, the Corradettis were on a religious pilgrimage to the shrine of Our Lady of Medjugorje in Croatia, Herzegovina. And while they were on this pilgrimage, the countrywide, who was a notorious lender, was conducting a closing put a lien on their home, their Ocean City home, on September 25th, when they were clearly halfway around the world. They returned on September 26th, unaware of what had happened. And this is a countrywide mortgage. Bank of New York purchased this discounted mortgage sometime after it had been put in place. There is a past history between the parties. There was an initial foreclosure action that was filed, I believe, in 2009. Mr. and Mrs. Corradetti, pro se, said they object to the entry of a final judgment. And for some inexplicable reason, countrywide, or back in New York, I should say, at that point, voluntarily dismissed that complaint. And then nothing happens for a period of 4 years. And then they institute the current foreclosure action in 2014. This is when the Corradettis retained counsel. A contested answer was filed. It was clear in the answer that there was a dispute as to the validity of the note and mortgage. It was clearly alleged that these were forgeries. And then apparently in 2015, concerned about those allegations, the Bank of New York files an amended complaint seeking equitable relief. There was extensive discovery undertaken for a period of years in this case. There were cross motions for summary judgment that were filed. And in their appellate pleadings, the plaintiff tries to conflate what was produced at the summary judgment motion and what was produced at trial. And I would respectfully ask that the court keep that distinction because that's important. And at there were cross motions for summary judgment that were denied by Judge Pickering. There was a motion for reconsideration that was denied by Judge Pickering. Judge Pickering outlined in detail what issues he had with the material facts presented by the plaintiff, and the plaintiff did nothing in advance of the trial to address those concerns of the court. The trial occurred over a two-day period on May 30th and May 31st of 2017. The plaintiff had an unrestricted right to introduce whatever relevant evidence they chose to, and they chose to introduce the testimony of one witness, James D'Orlando, who's a litigation manager for the servicing company, who had absolutely not one shred of relevant evidence that would address the issues that were before the trial court. So Judge Pickering, sitting as the trier of fact, heard the evidence, made decisions as to credibility, made assessments. He heard from Mrs. Corradetti, who emphatically said, "We were not in the United States on September 25th. We did not sign those documents. We never agreed to have Countrywide place a mortgage on our property." And she disputed all of the critical facts that were alleged by the plaintiff. and Judge Pickering found her to be credible. Not satisfied with Judge Pickering's decision, plaintiff appeals to the appellate division, and the appellate division, in a well-reasoned opinion authored by Judge Renoia and joined in by Judge Fuentes, affirmed the trial court's findings. And now, being dissatisfied with that, here we are today. There was discussion about the burden of proof. And to put it succinctly, the plaintiff has the burden of proof to establish their entitlement to foreclosure and the elements. And they failed in that. They failed to establish that the document was authentic. They failed to establish that there was ever a meeting of the minds between the Corradettis and Countrywide to allow Countrywide to place a lien on this property.
Mr. Lafferty, you accept, I take it, that you had the burden of demonstrating forgery by clear and convincing evidence in this case?
I do, Judge, and I believe that was clearly established by virtue of the fact that it would have been possible. We have a document, and you know, our law has procedures, and those procedures are in place to protect everyone.
I want you to finish that first sentence. It was impossible because, please.
Because the sworn testimony of the notary, who is authorized by the state to attest to the execution of documents, and the title agency, who's licensed by the state to conduct closings on behalf of parties. The clear evidence is that this closing took place on September 25th.
So that's a reasonable argument by any standard that the document was not signed on the date listed on September 25th. But what proof is there that it's a forgery, that it wasn't signed on some other date? September 26th, for example.
Coupled with that uncontroverted testimony. I mean, we have testimony from a notary public that this was signed on September 25th. That's the testimony. And it was a self-attestation clause. So we have that testimony. And then Mrs. Corradetti emphatically testified and that she did not execute that document, and that it was not her husband's signature. And in the face of that, the plaintiff brought forth no evidence, not one shred of evidence to support their position.
May I ask, can you tell us your theory of what happened here? It starts with a forgery, as you've explained, and then what? How are the two mortgages paid off to the tune of $1.7 million soon after this loan was made? Who paid them?
Mr. Chief Justice, I wasn't present in 2006, so I can't tell the court, and I'm not going to speculate before this court as to what may or may not have happened with other financing or other arrangements. I have no idea. All I know is that it's the burden of the plaintiff to establish that money trail, and they did nothing. There's not one wire transfer, not one canceled check. The only evidence is a forged HUD one that we know is forged because it's dated when the Corradettis were halfway around the world.
So I'm not asking you to speculate here. I'm asking you to factor in the other evidence that exists in the form of the documents that have been presented. We know that the mortgages were paid off. We know that there are 30 months of payments, 2.5 years worth of mortgage payments that are made, and so on. And we have the letter in which the objection is to the amount due and owing, not to the existence of the mortgage altogether. Is it fair to say that all of that factors into the analysis as to whether this is an entire fraud, this is a forgery?
Mr. Chief Justice, I would reply with a question. Where is the evidence that a dime of Countrywide's money found its way into those payoffs? There is absolutely no evidence.
And that's why I asked you, what's your theory? Where did that money, that $1.7 million, magically come from?
I can't answer, Your Honor. I don't know where Mr. Corradetti located or those funds or where those funds originated from. But what I do know is that it's the burden of the plaintiff to establish that the Countrywide funds were utilized to pay off those mortgages.
And counsel, can you respond to the HUD one issue? You've heard Mr. O'Donnell and Justice Solomon raised the issue too. The date on the HUD one, the printout is the 26th at what, 3:25 or whatever. What do you have to say about that? Even though it's dated, the signature is dated the 25th, the printout is the 26th. How do you explain that?
My response would be, first of all, I am not a title agency, so I have no idea how these HUD ones are generated. I have no idea whether that date is inserted or whether that date is self-generated or whether it can be generated on multiple copies of a HUD one. I have no idea. And there was no testimony in the record below that indicated that was the only date upon which that form could have been generated. I don't know, Justice Alvin. I mean,
so here's the other, and this is piggybacking off of the chief's question. Everyone's wondering about your client sitting in a house, okay, for like a number of years, and someone's paying off the mortgage, and they're sitting in the house. Like, who's doing that? Are there little goblins or fairies doing that? I mean, what's going on?
Justice Alvin, I can't answer who made those payments. What I can say is that the plaintiff failed to establish who did, and they, more importantly, failed to establish that the Corradettis had anything to do with those payments. And that is their burden. That isn't our burden, it's theirs. And they had 10 years to develop that evidence.
So look,
I have a question, if I could follow up on your HUD question, Justice Albin. The HUD calculations are done to a precise day. So did you or anyone of responsible for defending your clients engage in the forensic recalculation of those amounts to determine whether or not the anticipated date of closing was the 25th or the 26th, because that is a determinable fact. Anybody who's done a closing knows that it's calculated to the precise date of the closing. Even if a closing is done on a rolling basis, the HUD form is the ultimate determiner because that's what gets filed. Do you have an answer to that?
Justice Levecchia, I did not do those calculations. My client testified, incredibly so, that that document was also a forgery, that her signature was not on that document, and that she never attended that closing.
But this is important to understand what happened with the payoff of their prior mortgages, which your clients are not disputing happened. So there was a precise calculation made of the exact amount of principal and interest that needed to be paid off when those canceled prior mortgages were sent in and then returned by the recording agent, the county, the county officer responsible for that in Burlington.
Well, there's absolutely no evidence, Your Honor, that those two prior mortgages were paid off from Countrywide funds. So that calculation really wouldn't come into play unless you accept that fact, and we don't accept that.
Well, it would certainly help support the fact that it was paid off by that amount, wouldn't it? If it was done precisely to that date.
Well,
it would certainly help fill in some of the gaps that seems to be, at least you're suggesting, appear in this record.
Well, and I do suggest it, as did the appellate division, and those gaps were plaintiff's burden to establish, and plaintiff failed to establish those evidentiary facts. Mrs. Corradetti testified credibly that that she did not sign this document.
Can I ask you one question about that, the evidence to show who paid off what?
Yes, Your Honor.
A lot of talk about a HUD warrant. There's a lot of implications to falsifying a HUD warrant. Is the HUD one not evidence of who and what funds paid off what amounts? In fact, isn't that indeed conclusive evidence that those mortgages were deducted from the amount of the mortgage that of the plaintiffs now, and that that money went to pay off the existing mortgages? Isn't the HUD one not only evidence of that fact, but conclusive evidence of that fact?
But the trial court, Justice Solomon, found that the HUD one was not evidentiary.
Well, I'm asking you, that could be a legal error. What does a HUD one do? What does a HUD one tell us? It's required by federal law, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. And it's required to have certain things in it. And what it is required to show is what money was received and what that money, who that money went to. Isn't the HUD one at least evidence? You said there was not a scintilla, no evidence that the mortgage from Bank of New York paid off Countrywide. Well, yes, there is. There's a HUD one. Says it was. Says it was money used to pay taxes through a certain date, as Justice LeBecky said. Isn't that evidence, and maybe even conclusive evidence? I haven't looked at that federal statute since I stopped practicing law, but.
Justice Solomon, I mean, what the trial court found and what the appellate division affirmed was that the HUD one was incredible because it was a forged document as well.
Not what I asked.
Well, I mean,
the chief asked you a question. Well, who paid off the Countrywide mortgage? And you said there's no evidence of who paid it off. There's certainly no evidence that Bank of New York paid it off. And my question is, well, yes, there is. There's not just evidence. There's evidence that has all kinds of legal implications. It's called a HUD one.
But Your Honor, and I'm not trying to be argumentative.
You can. Go ahead. That's what we're here for.
I think where we're disconnecting is that there has to be credible, competent evidence. And that HUD one, that forged HUD one, is not credible, competent evidence. If you're asking me in a hypothetical where you don't have a forged document, where the court finds that it is credible evidence, then the HUD one may in fact be evidential. But that wasn't what the trial court determined, and that isn't what the appellate division determined.
But my question goes not to the signature on the HUD one. Regardless of who signed it, regardless of whether it was a forgery or not, the HUD one is a federally required document with certain, as I understand it, very specific statutory requirements. And the HUD one in this case, the only thing disputed is the signature, shows the exact amount of the mortgage that came in. And the exact amount, as Justice LeBecky pointed out, of the funds that went out and where they went. And nobody's challenged that. That HUD one was in evidence, may or may not have been signed by, and we can dispute whether what the evidence was of forgery or proof of forgery, may or may not have been signed, but nobody's questioning or has questioned the contents of the HUD one, which is in evidence. So doesn't the HUD one answer the chief's question?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor. I mean, the HUD one was questioned. For example, there's a representation on there that the Corradetti's contributed over $8,000 to this settlement. There's absolutely no proof of that. There's no
proof. The HUD one.
It's on the HUD form.
It's on the form.
I understand that, but there's no, you know, banks.
I get you.
Banks are highly regulated. We all know that. And there is absolutely not one banking record that supports any transaction that's purportedly reflected on this forged HUD one. That's the bottom line. I mean, There was absolutely not one.
Are you disputing the payments on the HUD one were made to satisfy the other mortgages and for the taxes? Are you challenging that? You're saying that didn't happen?
We're challenging that there's any proof in this record that any funds from Countrywide went to the benefit of this property.
So you're challenging that the mortgages were not paid, money did not go to satisfy those mortgages, no money was paid for taxes. That there's no proof that ever happened. Is that what you're challenging?
We are, Your Honor. Hmm?
Okay. So were there any lawsuits by the other mortgagors, any tax liens on that property because nothing was paid?
No, the Corradettis and the Bank of New York have been paying taxes for the last 10 years alternately, but not to my knowledge, there's been no other litigation.
The Corradettis were paying taxes on that on the property?
They have been in conjunction with the Bank of New York. It's been a race to the tax collector's office for the last few years to see who gets the payment in first.
Mr. Lafferty, does the HUD one indicate where the monies were, exactly to whom the monies were going to pay off the mortgage?
The HUD one does mention World Savings and Commerce Bank, Your Honor, yes.
So do you think that's really an incredible coincidence that like shortly after the HUD one, that mortgage winds up being satisfied? You have to admit that that's an incredible coincidence that this HUD one would indicate that Countrywide is doing that, but some other phantom financing source is paying off the loan. You got to admit those are like incredible coincidences, no?
Well, Justice, what I know is that we have evidentiary rules in our jurisprudence. And what I know is that the Bank of New York has never established that any Countrywide funds went to benefit this property.
It doesn't look to me like this case was well prosecuted by the plaintiff. But now the question is whether or not the court is going to put complete blinders on in terms of what probably occurred here and permit a party to be completely unjustly enriched that is sitting in a house, okay, where they've been paying someone a mortgage off and now wanting to get it free and clear, pretending that there is no mortgage. I mean, why don't you respond to suggestions?
Yeah, sure, Justice Alvin. The role of the appellate court is not to substitute its judgment for the trial court's findings if they were within the range of an acceptable decision, and that's in Ray Coleman. And it's not the role of the appellate court to fill in gaps in the plaintiff's proofs to make decisions that are not supported by sufficient credible evidence. And the plaintiff is asking this court to interpret the evidence or the lack thereof differently than the trial court that had the benefit of seeing and hearing the witnesses. And the appellate division refused to do this. And it's our argument respectfully that this court should likewise. The plaintiff has the burden of proof to establish entitlement to their foreclosure. They failed miserably in that burden. And it's not for this court to speculate or to make leaps in evidentiary findings that are really the province of the trial court in order to protect the plaintiff's case. That's just not what... That's not how it works in our system.
Mr. Lafferty, I mean, that's a proposition with which I absolutely agree, but there is a point in which, and the U.S. Supreme Court acknowledges it, when inferences made by a trial court can be said to be irrational, that is the point at which an appellate court may step in. You're right. Great deference is typically shown to the trial court, but there does reach a point where even the U.S. Supreme Court acknowledges that an appellate court can play a role in reviewing and rejecting those findings. So you would agree with that, right? Even though you're acknowledging it's a high standard.
I think it is. It's a very refined review, and the review of and believe me, I have all due respect for this court, but the review by this court is a review of the appellate division's action and whether the appellate division acted appropriately in reaching the conclusion that Judge Fuentes and Judge Vanoia reached. In their review of the trial court's actions. So I do agree with you, Justice Levesque.
Were you still answering Justice Levesque's question? Because if not, I have one question.
No, I was actually going to come back to you, Justice Solomon.
All right, good, because I got you. What was the evidence of forgery? You have a burden. It's by clear and convincing evidence. What was the evidence of forgery beyond the date when the HUD won? You have the passport showing they're not here on the 25th. You have the HUD won dated the 25th. The trial court relied, it looks like, in reading his opinion, exclusively on that to determine the defendant was credible that she did not sign that document, but he didn't find her credible as to the other matters. What was the evidence of forgery beside the date when the HUD won?
Well, the illegal notarization of the date on the mortgage was another component, I believe, when it was physically impossible for these folks to be anywhere near Toms River, New Jersey.
So if the notary backdated it, that's a crime.
I believe it is. I think Justice Albin does too.
I'm not disputing that it is or it isn't. That's the notary committed a crime if they backdated it.
I believe that's a violation of their obligations under the law, yes.
Is there any other evidence that it was a forgery?
Mrs. Corradetti's unrebutted testimony that it was not their signatures on any document.
I thought all the court concluded was that it could not be, she could not have signed it on the 25th because she was in Croatia. And the passport supported her credibility on that issue.
And the court also found as credible her testimony that she did not sign those documents, and her honest belief that she believed that she owned the property free and clear. Judge Pickering wrote a lengthy 50-page opinion.
So if I suggest that he relied exclusively on the passport and the date on the HUD-1, the signature on the HUD-1 date, in concluding that she was credible on that one issue, I would be wrong.
I'm never going to say you're wrong, Justice.
Well, you can. I hear that all the time, even from the other justices. You can say.
No, I don't believe that was, that's not my recollection of Judge Pickering's decision. I think Judge Pickering looked at the totality of the evidence presented by the defense and the lack of evidence presented by the plaintiff, and reached that conclusion that those were forged instruments.
Did anyone ask Judge Pickering to compare signatures from like a known sample of the Corradetti signatures to the ones that were on the HUD one and the mortgage note?
I don't believe, if you're asking if exemplars were produced to the court and for the court to examine those exemplars, I don't believe that happened at trial, Judge.
But we do have their signatures on the letter that was sent to the bank dated July 19th, 2010. It's 938A in the appendix. There's no dispute that they signed that letter, is that correct?
Mrs. Corradetti indicated she didn't recognize her signature on that letter. This is the July 2010 letter?
That's correct. And then there's an admission afterward at the appellate level that it was signed? No?
That's what counsel indicates. I believe what was actually in the appellate brief was that the trier of fact found that Mrs. Corradetti did in fact send that letter, Judge Pickering.
So we have two sets of signatures, at least. The HUD one, which you claim is a forgery, we understand, and the July 2010 letter that the judge found was signed by them.
Yes.
May I ask two other questions? And I know you weren't counsel of record at the trial, but—
I was.
You were?
I was.
Your colleague has told us that there was a request made for canceled checks from the Corradettis. What was the response?
Judge, we produced thousands of pages of documents at the request. And it wasn't Mr. O'Donnell or Riker Danzig. It was Cimento McNally, I believe, was representing the plaintiff at that time. We produced whatever documents we had. We produced bank ledgers. All those banks were available. All those documents were accessible.
Were bank statements and canceled checks for that 30-month period provided?
I'll be honest with you, I can't represent whether the canceled checks were. I believe the bank statements were. I mean, the discovery was handled by Mr. Jacobson not by me.
Are there debits for the mortgage payments in the 30 months of bank statements?
I can't answer that question. I don't know.
One other question, and I'm not asking you to abandon your position here. It is what it is, and we accept that. If the court goes with the dissent, Judge Accurso's dissent, what's the appropriate remedy from your perspective?
Well, if the court goes with the dissent and reverses the well-reasoned findings of the trial court and the appellate division, first of all, there'll be a message sent to unscrupulous lenders like Countrywide and unscrupulous notaries like Mr. Citarino that you can conduct yourself in any way that you choose, even if it's violative of the law, and you can do so with impunity.
What would the proper remedy be nonetheless?
If you were to reverse?
Yes.
Well, I mean, remanding it for a new trial. Mrs. Corradetti's not going to be able to testify, obviously. And her testimony would be based on the record below. So I probably agree with Mr. O'Donnell that a retrial would be essentially the same evidence that was presented at the first trial. At least from my perspective, it would be. So
maybe not. Maybe those canceled checks will be presented, like who they were, where those checks were actually going to, assuming that they exist.
Well, if the plaintiff wanted those into evidence, they should have done it in the first trial.
Agreed. But now we're talking of if there was a new trial. You said it would be presented on the same evidence, but there may be other evidence that could be presented that would clarify some of the questions that have been raised during the arguments.
I understand that, but the questions—
That's okay. They have been, if you didn't, if those canceled checks would have been in your client's possession, is that right?
I don't know if my clients kept their—
Well, they normally go back, either a copy of it sent but with the bank statement, or the actual checks were sent back with the bank statements.
Well, this was 10 years before, or 12 years.
No, I'm not asking you about 10 years. I'm just asking you a normal procedure process is that the person who writes a check, their bank account, those checks come back with the monthly statement, or at least a statement of the checks that were cashed to whatever made payable to. They would have been in your client's possession, if at all, right? So if they're not produced, and you don't know if they're produced, there would be no way for the bank to be able to provide those at time trial, would there?
Your Honor, I believe banks keep copies of all of the checks. At least in my experience, they do. And copies of all the canceled checks.
Can
Can I ask the question in a different way, Mr. Lafferty? If there is anything to be retried, if we do not accept the finding of forgery and reverse on that point, what more do you have to prove on behalf of your clients to defend against the plaintiff's action?
Justice LeBecca, we believe that we carried our burden of proof. Our burden of proof.
Please answer my question. What more beyond forgery do you want to present in defense of this claim of your clients having defaulted on the mortgage?
Justice, we presented all the evidence that we wanted to present at the first trial.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I have one question. Is it possible for this court to find that even if there was a forgery, it was forged by the authorized representatives of the Corradettis?
Let's, Lafferty, do you want the question posed again?
Yes, Your Honor, please.
Mr. Lafferty, my question is this. Even if the court were to find that the signatures were authorized, were forgeries, could the court also find that the forgeries must have been by the authorized representatives of the Corradettis? Because of everything else that lines up in terms of the HUD-1 and the payments and the taking care of the other mortgage, could the court do that based upon its record?
Well, Justice Albin, I would submit not. I mean, there's absolutely no evidence that the Corradettis authorized anyone to sign anything on their behalf. And in fact, Mary Ann Corradetti credibly testified at trial that she authorized no one to execute documents on her behalf, and that this was not a post-dated document executed by her and her husband, or a predated document executed by her and her husband. So the credible evidence here is simply that these documents were forged instruments, and that's the only credible evidence here. And the HUD-1 in and of itself was not accepted by the trial court as substantive evidence. And a HUD-1, according to my understanding, is only effective if it has signatures affixed to it by the parties to be charged. And it was determined that that document also was a forged document. So, I mean.
Well, who would have done this? I mean, this is, it's the last question I'm going to ask, and it's maybe redundant, that the mortgage company like comes in, affixes a mortgage, and then magically the prior mortgage is paid off and the Corradettis are making payments to someone, but not to this mortgage company. I mean, to what degree is a court just to put blinders on?
Well, I think that the appropriate question is, to what degree does a court require someone attempting to foreclose on a property to present the competent, credible evidence that the law requires them to produce? And that's, I think, the real question here. And the real answer here is that the plaintiff woefully failed to produce the evidence required to support its case. And it is not for this court or the appellate division or any court to speculate or fill in gaps or do any work on behalf of any party, but rather to assess objectively the credible evidence. And if you look at the credible evidence, there's no credible evidence that any of the Countrywide monies went to any prior lender. There's no credible evidence that the Corradettis made any payment to the title company to facilitate this closing. There's no credible evidence that the court.
Counsel, I have one question. I know your position is that there's no evidence that your clients made these payments. And the chief, I think earlier asked whether your client, you produced pursuant to discovery requests from the plaintiff's records, bank records, and other information that was requested. You indicated that you did, but that your colleague handled a lot of the discovery. But then when you were asked whether those bank records reflected any payments, any payments on that mortgage you didn't know. So I just wanted to go back to that because I want an understanding of whether you know what those bank records reflect, because your position is there's no evidence that they made those payments. You have no idea. We're supposed to be operating in a world where we have no idea who made those payments and that there's no evidence that your clients made those payments. So, I mean, if the records were produced, if you have those records, what do they show? Do they show debits? Do they show payments made on those mortgages?
Madam Justice, I'm not going to speculate what those records show. I don't recall what those records showed. I do know that they were not part of the record in the trial court. So I'm assuming that plaintiff's counsel found those to be not beneficial or supportive of their case. But I can't, as I stand here now, I can't recite, and I'm not going to make a representation to this court about what those records do or don't show. I just know that the record below fails to demonstrate any record of any payment by the Corradettis to Countrywide.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to say in closing, Mr. Lafferty?
Well, I'm over my time, but very briefly, what we're asking this court to do is to make a decision sustaining the well-reasoned decision of Judge Fuentes and Judge Bonoya, and the well-reasoned decision and findings of fact and credibility of Judge Pickering. And we ask that the court affirm the decision of the appellate division. Thank you very much for your time and patience.
Thank you. Mr. O'Donnell, rebuttal. And if I may ask a question before you start, can you at some point cover this? In discovery, you said there were no canceled checks that you recall, were there bank statements? And do they reflect debits? Did you receive bank statements in discovery in response to requests?
I do not. I was the appellate counsel, and I don't, from our review of the records, no, I don't recall bank statements. I'm not saying that bank statements were not produced. I don't recall it. I don't recall it. I just don't recall them. Yet.
Please go ahead.
Okay. I'd like to correct three factual issues in the opposition. First, Mr. Lafferty said the Corradettis and Bank of New York have been paying taxes and insurance, and it's been a race to the courthouse. That's only true after the appellate division, after the appellate division argument. From 2006 all the way up to the appellate division argument, the only one who paid taxes was the Bank of New York. We know that by, if you look at the Bank of America ledger, for all 30 payments, there's another subsequent payment by Bank of America for taxes and for insurance. And then if you go to the Bayview ledger, there are all of the payments for taxes and insurance are made by the bank. We also heard some reference to Countrywide and being unscrupulous. Well, there's never been an allegation of any predatory lending. The interest rate on this loan was 6.75%. And we know from a commitment letter that it saved the Corradettis over $3,000 a month on their payments. We also heard reference to the closing, possibly being Mrs. Corradetti not being Tom Gerber. Well, the mortgage was notarized in Burlington. And that's where Mrs. Corradetti lived until 2013 at 130 Taylor Lane. Now, I want to address an illegal error both lower courts made. And both lower courts were able to just dismiss the HUD one on the basis that the trial court found it was forged and therefore is invalid. An invalid instrument can still be competent and admissible evidence. And I would cite the court to the Ortley decision, 30 NJL 35, and Ryder v. Slockbrower, 107 NJL. Specifically, in those cases, in Ortley, even though the deed was not effective, it still was evidence of a contract. That's Ortley. And in Ryder v. Stockbrow, the contract for was not enforceable under the statute of fraud, but it was still admissible as to the terms and the payment. And that's what we're saying. We keep referring to the HUD as being forged. It wasn't forged by the settlement agent. He signed with regard to the payments that were made. So the HUD is absolutely admissible evidence. And if it wasn't, you almost could never have equitable subrogation in any forgery cases. And we know, of course, that you can from the case law. I'd also like to cite the court to, we've had a lot of discussion about the burden of proof and what clear and convincing evidence is. And I'd like to cite the court to N. Ray Persky, where it says clear and convincing evidence is evidence that is, quote, so clear, direct and weighting and convincing as to enable the fact finder to come to a clear conviction without hesitancy of the precise facts at issue. And I would submit that all Judge Pickering and the appellate division relied on was that Mrs. Corradetti was in Croatia on September 25th. There wasn't one other fact in evidence that they could have relied on that she didn't sign the document on the 26th. The payment of the prior mortgage notarized in Burlington. Everything leads to the very fact, as Judge Accursa pointed out, for the three-day period of rescission. It was required for the 25th to allow this loan to fund before the end of the month. And that happens. And Judge Accursa, in footnote 10 of her opinion, expressly gives you the statutes and case law that supports that backdating sometimes does indeed occur. And that's exactly what happened here. Also, there was a reference to Bank of New York getting this loan on a discounted basis. That's not really relevant, but there's no evidence of that happening at all. So I would simply, and finally, Mr. Rafferty referred to, there was testimony from the notary, his self-attestation. The document was notarized. The notary couldn't be fined. There was no testimony from anyone other than Mrs. Corradetti, what happened. And Mrs. Corradetti was found to be not credible in every single instance, except for this one instance that she didn't sign the Bank of New York mortgage. And the only evidence to support that credibility is the very fact that she was in Croatia. That's it. And Mr. Lafferty also said that when asked about whether she conceded in the appellate brief that she signed the July 19, 2010 letter, Judge Pickering expressly in his opinion relied on the fact that he testified she did not sign that letter. In their appellate brief, they stated she did. That is an admission. That is not a statement of what the trial court found. That is very, very significant because basically they've admitted they put a false fact in front of the fact finder. And in addition, with regard to the 2003 Commerce mortgage, even though Judge Pickering found it was signed, entered into, she denied she signed that as well. And on page 4 of their appellate brief, they again admit that Mrs. Corradetti did indeed enter into the 2003 Commerce mortgage. So you have a witness that was not only found to be not credible by the trial court, but that even after the trial contradicted herself. And the reason for that is the story is too bizarre to be true.
Mr. Dunn.
No rational fact finder could find that this mortgage was not signed by both Corradetti's involuntary entity.
One final question with respect to remedy. Mr. Lafferty says, of course, that there should be an affirmance here, but if not, a retrial. Is there additional evidence that you would present on a retrial? You've alluded to things that took place after the trial, and we've discussed other matters as well.
Well, yes, Your Honor. I certainly think there certainly could be additional evidence, and I think the justices have educated me. I certainly would be looking at those bank records to see whether there was any evidence. I suspect I'm going to find there were no bank records produced, but I can't say that. Then subpoenas out directly to the banks, and we could certainly get to the bottom of that. You know, I certainly could.
Understood.
Handwriting expert, there is evidence I could present.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. I appreciate your patience during the argument. We'll take the matter under advisement.
Can I ask one question related to something here? Very brief. The chief asked a question as to whether the trial court ever compared signatures, either from any documents to the documents in the HUD-1. Did the trial court make any comparison, maybe it was Justice Adman, make any comparison among the signatures?
No, the trial court did not, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.